This is day two of this February two-day session, 2015. I'm going to read again from this book by Bhante Gunaratana, Mindfulness in Plain English. And I'm continuing from this chapter entitled, What to Do with Your Mind. So picking right up, he says, focus on the natural and spontaneous movement of the breath. Don't try to regulate it or emphasize it in any way. Most beginners have some trouble in this area. In order to help themselves focus on the sensation, they unconsciously accentuate their breathing. The result is a forced and unnatural effort that actually inhibits concentration rather than helping it. Don't increase the depth of your breath or its sound. This latter point is especially important in group meditation. Loud breathing can be a real annoyance to those around you. Just let the breath move naturally as if you were asleep. A little dangerous there. Let go and allow the process to go along at its own rhythm. In Vipassana meditation, they maybe are a little more strict about this, but this is really a good point. A lot of times, people fall into the habit, especially working on a koan, of sort of squeezing the breath, the throat, and I've done that myself, and I think sometimes. When you're just struggling to find some way to get a hold of the koan, you try anything, and sometimes it helps. But as a general practice, it becomes a crutch. And what happens is you hear your breath, and that means you're practicing, of course, because there's that breath that you're making all that noise with. And then you can sort of, go off and do whatever. Leave the baby in the car and go shopping. I think he's right that it can actually inhibit concentration if it's continued too long. The other thing that occurs to me, of course, is the practice that we have on the last night of a seven-day session of voicing the koan. And this goes back to Japan. Roshi told me that one of our old members back in the 70s went and visited with Tangen Roshi, and it was just the two of them sitting together, and at Tangen's, it was Tangen's idea, of course, the two of them voiced their koan. I can't remember how long it was, but it was for a long time, for a half an hour or maybe an hour, just bellowing moo at the top of their voice. And that can get you, that can blow the cobwebs out. There's no question it can be effective. But the problem is when it becomes a crutch, when the audible breathing just becomes a habit. And it's important, too, to be able to concentrate without doing that. For some people, they've done it so long, it's hard for them to let it go. But there is a great deal of value. Speaking from my own experience, I wasn't even realizing how much I did this. I think I still occasionally am audible to people near me. No one's complained recently, but there was one session I did where I was monitoring, and the timer sort of blew me into Roshi, and that's when I first began realizing, okay, this isn't actually helping my concentration. So he says, let go and allow the process to go along at its own rhythm. This sounds easy, but it's trickier than you think. Do not be discouraged if you find your own will getting in the way. Just use that as an opportunity to observe the nature of conscious intention. Watch the delicate interrelation between the breath, the impulse to control the breath, and the impulse to cease controlling the breath. You may find it frustrating for a while, but it is highly profitable as a learning experience, and it is a passing phase. Eventually, the breathing process will move along under its own steam, and you will feel no impulse to manipulate it. At this point, you will have learned a major lesson about your own compulsive need to control the universe. So this it's really even a broader point than just this letting the breath proceed naturally. Working on a koan as well, we often have this feeling that we need to add something. We need to somehow enhance our mind states, or make the koan more vivid. And we can fall into trying to put something there that isn't there. It's really a lack of faith that everything we need, we already have. If you truly believe that, when that truly sinks in over months or years, decades of practice, you realize you don't need to add anything. Then that faith, the faith that everything is there, can feed that doubt sensation. It powers our zazen. But we have to get out of the way, as he says. But going back to breathing, which seems so mundane and uninteresting at first glance, is actually an enormously complex and fascinating procedure. It is full of delicate variations if you look. There is inhalation and exhalation, long breath and short breath, deep breath, shallow breath, smooth breath, and ragged breath. These categories combine with one another in subtle and intricate ways. Observe the breath closely. Really study it. You find enormous variations and a constant cycle of repeated patterns. It is like a symphony. Don't observe just the bare outline of the breath. There is more to see here than just an in-breath and an out-breath. Every breath has a beginning, middle, and end. Every inhalation goes through a process of birth, growth, and death, and every exhalation does the same. The depth and speed of your breathing changes according to your emotional state, the thoughts that flow through your mind, and the sounds you hear. Study these phenomena. You will find them fascinating. Anything that you look at closely, consistently, comes to life. He offers a caveat here. This does not mean, however, that you should be sitting there having little conversations with yourself inside your head. There is a short ragged breath, and there is a deep long one. I wonder what's next. That's not meditation. That's not vipassana, he says. That is thinking. You will find this sort of thing happening, especially in the beginning. This, too, is a passing phase. Simply note the phenomenon and return your attention toward the observation of the sensation of breath. Mental distractions will happen again, but return your attention to your breath again and again and again and again for as long as it takes until distraction no longer occurs. When you first begin this procedure, expect to face some difficulties. Your mind will wander off constantly, darting around like a bumblebee and zooming off on wild tangents. Try not to worry. The monkey mind phenomenon is well known. So I'm not sure if the mind is supposed to be a bumblebee or a monkey, but I think the point is the same. This is something that every seasoned meditator has had to deal with. They have pushed through it one way or another, and so can you. When it happens, just note the fact that you have been thinking, daydreaming, worrying, or whatever. Gently but firmly, without getting upset or judging yourself for straying, simply return to the simple physical sensation of the breath. Then do it again the next time, and again, and again, and again. Somewhere in this process, you will come face to face with a sudden and shocking realization that you are completely crazy. Your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels, barreling pell-mell down the hill, utterly out of control and helpless. No problem. You are not crazier than you were yesterday. It has always been this way, and you just never noticed. You are also no crazier than everyone else around you. The only difference is you have confronted the situation and they have not. Sometimes we compare it when people first begin practicing. This is the first thing, of course, they run up against, this monkey mind. And it's like floating downstream, and now you've decided to plant your feet in the bed of the stream, and suddenly you realize how strong the current is. As long as you're floating with your thoughts, you don't notice them. It's the normal state of mind for almost everyone. Says they feel relatively comfortable, that does not mean that they are better off. Ignorance may be bliss, but it does not lead to liberation. I think most people who are lost in their thoughts are not actually blissful, but it's true that facing up to it sometimes doesn't feel so great. Don't let this realization unsettle you. It is a milestone, actually, a real sign of progress. The very fact that you have looked at the problem straight in the eye means that you are on your way up and out of it. In the wordless observation of the breath, there are two states to be avoided, thinking and sinking. The thinking mind manifests most clearly as the monkey mind phenomenon we have just been discussing. The sinking mind is almost the reverse. As a general term, sinking denotes any dimming of awareness. At its best, it is a sort of mental vacuum in which there is no thought, no observation of the breath, no awareness of anything. It is a gap, a formless mental gray area, sort of like dreamless sleep. Sinking mind is a void. Avoid it. In Zen, the term we use is the dead void. It can feel like progress because the thoughts are gone. But we need to be alert. We need to be penetrating, looking within. The body has to be engaged. It says meditation is an active function. Concentration is a strong, energetic attention to one single item. Awareness is a bright, clean alertness. Samadhi, which means concentration, and sati, which means mindfulness, these are the two faculties we wish to cultivate. And sinking mind contains neither. At its worst, it will put you to sleep. Even at its best, it will simply waste your time. Skipping ahead a bit, says the meditation experience is not a competition. It's a good point to let sink in. It's not a competition. There is a definite goal, but there is no timetable. What you are doing is digging your way deeper and deeper through layers of illusion toward realization of the supreme truth of existence. The process itself is fascinating and fulfilling. It can be enjoyed for its own sake. There is no need to rush. Don't think about your problems during your practice. Push them aside very gently. Take a break from all that worrying and planning. Let your meditation be a complete vacation. People often say they are so busy that when they meditate, it just feels like they don't have enough time. There's so many things waiting for them the minute they get off the mat, and sometimes even the time for meditation is very short. But that can change. When you sit down on the mat, there's nothing else you really need to do. And as your practice develops, you're able to find space there. It really is a vacation from all the cares and worries of your normal day. Begin to really look forward to it and find places to sit, times to sit, that may not have occurred to you before. Of course, when you get to Sesshin, it's such a blessing. It's also an issue, of course, as we mentioned before, on this last day of Sesshin, there's so many thoughts that are crowded in the wings wanting to come to consciousness about what's going to happen after Sesshin. It's really important, it's really valuable to not to make your mind up, not to give in to those thoughts, not to engage with them, to continue to focus on the practice right up till the final bell. And when you've done it once, then you can do it again. It says, trust yourself. Trust your own ability to deal with these issues later, using the energy and freshness of mind that you built up during your meditation. Trust yourself in this way, and it will actually occur. Don't set goals for yourself that are too high to reach. Be gentle with yourself. You're trying to follow your own breathing continuously and without a break. That sounds easy enough, so you will have a tendency at the outset to push yourself to be scrupulous and exacting. This is unrealistic. Take time in small units instead. Come to the part that went through my forehead like a silver bullet when Roshi read it. Take time in small units instead. At the beginning of an inhalation, make the resolve to follow the breath just for the period of that one inhalation. Even this is not so easy, but at least it can be done. Then at the start of the exhalation, resolve to follow the breath for just that one exhalation, all the way through. You will still fail repeatedly, but keep at it. Every time you stumble, start over. Take it one breath at a time. This is the level of the game where you can actually win. Stick with it. Fresh resolve with every breath cycle. Tiny units of time. Observe each breath with care and precision, taking it one split second on top of another, with fresh resolve piled one on top of the other. In this way, continuous and unbroken awareness will eventually result. Try it. Mindfulness of breathing is a present moment awareness. When you are doing it properly, you are aware only of what is occurring in the present. You don't look back and you don't look forward. You forget about the last breath. You don't anticipate the next one. When the inhalation is just beginning, you don't look ahead to the end of that inhalation. You don't skip forward to the exhalation that is to follow. You stay right there with what is actually taking place. The inhalation is beginning, and that's what you pay attention to. That and nothing else. This meditation is a process of retraining the mind. The state you are aiming for is one in which you are totally aware of everything that is happening in your own perceptual universe exactly the way it happens. Exactly when it is happening, total unbroken awareness in present time. This is an incredibly high goal, and not to be reached all at once. It takes practice, so we start small. We start by becoming totally aware of one small unit of time, just one single inhalation. And when you succeed, you're on your way to a whole new experience of life. I'm going to go back to what he said earlier, gently but firmly, without getting upset or judging yourself for straying, simply return to the simple physical sensation of the breath. Then do it again the next time, and again, and again, and again. When we do that, you begin to do that, it can feel like a real burden. People feel, I can only do that so long. I've got to get some relief somewhere. It reminds me of Sisyphus rolling the rock up the hill. And I have something I want to read from Joko Beck. She was a Zen teacher in San Diego. She died in the last few years. I'm not sure quite how long ago. Probably longer than I think. This is from a book she published called Nothing Special, Living Zen. Charlotte Joko Beck with Steve Smith. And this is from a chapter entitled, I believe, Sisyphus and the Burden of Life. It says, Greek mythology tells the story of Sisyphus, king of Corinth, condemned by the gods to Hades and eternal punishment. Endlessly he had to roll an enormously heavy boulder up a hill, and when it reached the top, it would roll down again. He struggled to bring the boulder to the top of the hill, only to watch it roll back down over and over again for eternity. Like all myths, this story contains a teaching. And then she throws it open to her students, and there's various back and forth. And then we're going to pick up with what Joko has to say. She says, if we can see that there is just this moment, then pushing the rock up the hill or watching it roll back down are in a way the same thing. Our ordinary interpretation is that Sisyphus's task is difficult and unpleasant, yet all that happens is simply pushing the rock and watching it roll back, moment by moment. Like Sisyphus, we are all just doing what we're doing, moment by moment. But to that activity, we add judgments and ideas. Hell lies not in pushing the rock, but in thinking about it, in creating ideas of hope and disappointment, in wondering if we will finally get the rock to stay at the top. I've worked so hard, maybe this time the boulder will stay. Our efforts do make things happen, and in making things happen, we get to the next second. Perhaps the boulder will stay at the top for a while. Perhaps it won't. Neither event is in itself good or bad. The weight of the boulder, the burden, is the thought that our life is a struggle and that it should be other than it is. When we judge our burden to be unpleasant, we look for ways to escape. Perhaps one person gets drunk to forget about pushing the boulder. Another manipulates people into helping push it. Often we try to shift the burden onto someone else so we can escape the work. What would be the enlightened state for King Sisyphus? If he pushes the rock a few thousand years, What may he finally realize? The student says, to be one with pushing in each moment. And Joko says, just to push the rock and have abandoned hope that his life will be other than it is. Most of us imagine that the enlightened state will feel much better than pushing a rock. Have you ever awakened in the morning and muttered, I don't even want to think about all the things I have to do today? But life is as it is, and our practice is not about having life feel good, even though that's a very human hope. We all like things that make us feel good. We especially like partners who make us feel good. If our partner doesn't make us feel good, we assume that things have to be changed, that he or she needs to change. Because we are human, we think that feeling good is the aim of life. But if we simply push our current boulder and practice being aware of what goes on with us as we push, we slowly transform. What does it mean to transform? And the helpful student comes in. More acceptance, less judgment, more relaxation with life, and openness to life. And Joko says, openness to life and acceptance are a bit off, though it's hard to find words that are exactly right. Finally, the student says, right now. And Joko says, yes. But how do we live it? Suppose I get up in the morning with a headache and have a heavy schedule before me. We all have days like this. What does it mean to be a zero with that? To add no thoughts. Student says, it means simply to be here with all of my feelings and all of my thoughts, just being here, not adding anything extra to what is. Joko, yes, and even if we do add something extra, that is also part of the package. This is a really important point. That is also part of the package, part of life as it is this moment. Part of the package is, I just don't want to do this day. When that thought is what I acknowledge as being present, then I am just pushing my boulder. I go through the difficult day and I go to bed, and what do I get to do the next day? Somehow the boulder slipped back down the hill while I was asleep, so here I go again. Push, push, push. I hate this. Yes, I know I hate it. I wish there were some way out, but there isn't, or at least I don't see a way out right now. Perfect in being as it is. One of the diseases of practice is to think we need to reject all our negative thoughts. It's more subtle than that. They're real. The thought appeared. We had the thought. I wish I wasn't here. We acknowledge it, but we don't buy into it. It isn't a call to action. She says, when we truly live each moment, what happens to the burden of life? What happens to our boulder? If we are totally what we are in every second, we begin to experience life as joy. Standing between us and a life of joy are our thoughts, our ideas, our expectations, our hopes and fears. It's not that we have to be totally willing to push the rock. We can be unwilling as long as we acknowledge our unwillingness and simply feel it. Unwillingness is fine. A major part of any serious practice is, I don't want to do it. And we don't. But when our unwillingness drifts into efforts to escape, that's another matter. Well, I'll have another piece of chocolate cake. I think there's one left. I'll call up my friends. We'll talk about how terrible things are. I'll creep into a corner so I can really worry about how bad my life is and feel sorry for myself. It's our judgment about what we're doing that is the cause of our unhappiness. Our practice is to see that we are just pushing to get to that basic fact. Nobody realizes this all the time. I certainly don't. But I notice that people who have been practicing for some time begin to have a sense of humor about their burden. After all, the thought that life is a burden is only a concept. We're simply doing what we're doing, second by second by second. The measure of fruitful practice is that we feel life less as a burden and more as a joy. That does not mean there is no sadness, but the experience of sadness is exactly the joy. This is true. It's a privilege sometimes to feel sadness. She says, if we don't find such a shift happening over time, then we haven't yet understood what practice is. The shift is a very reliable barometer. I was reminded of Sisyphus during the term intensive. One of our out-of-town members, sent in his report, and he quoted Camus, the French existentialist, who said, "One must imagine Sisyphus happy." it really it brings to mind the criticism that some people level at Buddhism, which is that it's a pessimistic religion. We're always talking about the certainty of death, the unsatisfactory nature of reality, impermanence of all things. The alternative is to pretend that life is other than it is. Don't need to get out of it, we need to get into it. To live our lives fully, to be completely who we are. And we have this practice. We have the privilege of being able to practice. Have other people to practice with. To know that our own efforts help other people, help the people sitting alongside us. To be able to take some of what we learn, even if we can't explain it, just to be out in the world, living life moment by moment, not getting caught up in our ideas or other people's ideas, not being lost in our judgments, our indignation, our prescriptions for what other people should do. It all starts with attending to this moment, this one moment of practice. Having faith in the process, giving ourselves over to this process. We'll stop here and recite the four vows.